Wednesday afternoon. And we had a little time to recover from our luncheon. So this afternoon we're going to be conducting a legislative roundtable, and this is kind of a companion to the mayor's roundtable that we had before lunch, where Mayor Harris went through some of the efforts on the part of the Louisiana Municipal Association to actually give some light legislation through Louisiana's process, and he was fortunate to get, I think, at least one of his measures did get adopted, and he understands that you don't always get this passed the first time you propose it, but if you keep on at it and you've got a lot of fortitude, eventually you will prevail to the right thing. So this afternoon, we've got Jason Jordan, who is the Director of Policy at the American Legion Association, correct? And the first time I met Jason, I went to the American Planning Association Fall Leadership Conference, which is conducted usually in September in Washington, D.C. And Jason gives a beautiful presentation on national planning initiatives, and he describes how we take that through the congressional process and all the advocacy that he does on behalf of the Planning Association. And fits very well into what we're trying to do with the competitive grant that we got from the chapter president's council from the ATA to kind of jumpstart our legislative agenda. So we invited Jason, and he graciously agreed to fly in and spend some time with us and present his findings on how he does this, and then we hope to be able to translate it to the state level. So I've got also on our panel, and we're more facilitators than anything, but I've got the famous Timothy Henry Jackson on the end, who, you know, already gone through his bio, so we don't need to do that. And then, of course, we have Ed Elam, who is our immediate panel president of the ABALA, and, of course, he works with Burke Klein here in New Orleans in planning. And so we're going to be facilitating the discussion after Jason's presentation. So I'll give you Jason.
Thanks very much. Very kind introduction. It's great to be with you this afternoon. My presentation is going to focus on a few things. I'm going to start out by giving you a little bit of an overview about kind of where we've been over the last year, congressionally speaking, mostly, a little bit on the administration, and then talk a little bit about, as we move into the new year in the 114th Congress, kind of what we're likely to see and expect. One of the things that the 113th Congress was known for is doing a whole lot of not much. It was one of the least productive Congresses as measured by the number of bills signed into law. But one of the things that the 113th was really terrific at is creating a word that no one's heard before that really alienated a lot of the American public. The Cromnibus, as it was dubbed, was a piece of legislation that was the last train out of the station legislatively for the last Congress. It was the big omnibus bill. The word itself is a combination of CR, which stands for Continuing Resolution, and an omnibus, which is the legislative process where essentially they wrap all of the spending bills for the year into one big piece because they couldn't pass them individually over the prior year. So the CR omnibus or omnibus was their sort of last-ditch effort to provide funding for all federal programs to run through the end of the fiscal year. So you might say, well, then what is that CR doing hanging out on the front end of that work? What's the continuing resolution part? So I hate to get into too much hill speak on all this, but it's helpful, I think, to understand what this bill does. Continuing resolution basically just puts in law that things will stay as they are in terms of funding for an agency over whatever period of time that CR lasts. It's a way of punting without having an agency or the full federal government shut down, which is something we didn't see during the Congress. So the CR that came from Omnibus applies only to one agency, to the Department of Homeland Security. So this was Congress's reaction to the executive order that the President signed on immigration, because immigration programs are connected to the Department of Homeland Security. So the spending for all the other agencies was set, and I'm going to go through some of the key programs for you, through the end of the fiscal year, through September 30th of 2015. But for programs in Homeland Security, that funding only lasts until the end of February. And that becomes important. I'm going to touch on this in more detail in a few minutes. But while it's true that DHS is responsible for immigration programs, that's also where FEMA lives. And so all of the programs that FEMA funds relate to hazard mitigation, for instance, would be affected by any controversy at the end of February related to the Department of Homeland Security and ultimate funding. And in fact, ironically, a lot of the programs at DHS that are related to public health and safety, things like PSA and some of the other programs that are sort of on the front lines of dealing with terrorist threats and things of that nature, are exempted from any shutdown. So a lot of the programs that DHS is known for would actually continue at some level past the deadline, but programs, again, such as hazard mitigation, would be shut down until a spending bill was put in place. As we stand here today, it looks like there's actually going to be an agreement that will keep DHS in business, but it does mean that we're going to be in for an early cliff in this Congress, something that the last several years on Capitol Hill has been the only way to get anything to move with a deadline. In addition to providing funding levels, one of the other pieces that the Omnibus bill does, it includes some policy provisions. So I'm going to go through some of that information with you here. Let me start on the funding side for a handful of programs that I know many of you have some experience with. This chart just simply shows you the FY14, the previous funding level. The red bar is the funding levels that were provided for in the new legislation. What you will notice here, and this is true for many of the programs that ACA is most engaged on, the funding levels are pretty consistent. So we did not see, for the first time in some years, major reductions in any of these accounts. And in that sense, I think our expectations have gotten more modest in recent years. I think even though these aren't increased in the way we might like to see them, it does represent something of a victory in so much as they were spared a deeper cut. So but the first program here is HUD Choice Neighborhoods Initiative. This is a program where HUD provides both planning and capital grants in a competitive fashion to rehabilitate public housing and assisted, federally assisted housing to promote mixed-income communities. CDBG, Community Development Block Grant Program, is probably the biggest single program that we're engaged in on an appropriation side, on funding advocacy year to year. When we have surveyed members, as we've done pretty consistently over the last few years, the two programs that always come to the top in terms of concerns that members have at the federal level, one is CDBG, the other is the Surface Transportation Program, and both are very much at the top of our agenda for this coming year. The CDBG was held pretty low, small adjustment there from just over $3 billion to last $3 billion in FY15. The home program saw a small decline from $1 billion to $900 million. Home is an affordable housing program. A lot of communities use home dollars in conjunction with CDBG dollars for housing redevelopment projects. And home has seen very steep declines. So even though it lost a little more ground this year, the curve was bent a little bit in this bill. And I mentioned we sort of saw the final funding levels as a bit of a victory, so I want to show you this slide to give you a sense of why we felt that way. So this graph, instead of looking at 14 versus 15, what it shows you is where the two sides of the Capitol, the House side and the Senate side, were heading into the debate over the omnibus bill. So you can see the blue bars were the House has pegged funding for various programs. The red bar is where the Senate has proposed funding level. And almost across the board, the final resolution looked a heck of a lot more like the Senate proposal than it did the House proposal. And so for that reason, I think it was a bit of a victory in terms of the funding level at the end. It also stripped out some of the language that was really problematic in the House bill related to a number of programs like the Tiger Grant program in transportation. The House had attempted to limit the eligibility of Tiger funds exclusively to highway projects, whereas the program had always been very multimodal, very flexible at the local level. So that language was ultimately dropped. I'd like to show this chart, and if any of you have seen presentations at the National Conference or at the Ball Policy Conference, I've showed this many times, but for CDBG, I think it's helpful to look at the sort of sweep of history, if you will, for overall funding for this program. So the program was launched in the middle of the 70s. It's actually a Republican program funded by President Ford, funded at about $2.5 billion back in the middle 70s. You can see that it hit its high watermark in the mid-90s, then was fairly flat for a number of years, and then in recent years we've seen sort of steep decline. What this chart doesn't reflect, of course, is any adjustment for inflation over that period of time. We have done that calculation. If you adjust for inflation, the program should be about $11 million. So that's just pure lost purchasing power in the program. The other thing to keep in mind when you look at this chart is the fact that as communities grow in population, they become, if they hit certain thresholds, entitlement communities. So you have more communities, far more communities, at the table eligible for CDBG dollars by formula today than you had in 1975. So while the program, you know, is slightly above the middle 70s level, you can see the erosion, the actual impact of those dollars. Now, it's simply not realistic, as much as I might wish that it were, to expect we're going to get a $12 billion allocation for community development block grant program. It's helpful, I think, for people to see kind of where we have been and where we are here, in part because if you look at the overall outlays at the federal level for domestic programs, particularly domestic discretionary programs, and by discretionary, these are programs that aren't guided by statute for mandatory outlays, so Congress, the administration, on an annual basis, have to go in and decide up or down exactly where they will end up. If you look at the overall funding levels, that's where the debate tends to be, right? How much are we spending overall? Is that too much, too little? What's the debt situation? But the savings that have come in recent years, and you can see that the overall federal outlays have come down, they've largely come down thanks to cuts in programs like CDBG. So when we go to the Capitol Hill and talk about this program, one of the points we always try to make is that we have already experienced a disproportionate amount of the fiscal pain. So as we look forward into new budget years, it's important that members of Congress understand that some programs have been more burdened by fiscal austerity policies than others, and CDBG certainly falls in that category. One of the big problems, structural problems, that we're going to have to grapple with on CDBG going forward is the fact that it exists not just sort of in isolation. When Congress looks at the overall HUD budget, CDBG is, for better or worse, competing directly with programs like the Section 8 voucher program, all the other housing assistance programs. And frequently you will hear members of Congress say, well, we like CDBG, but we're not prepared to put people on the street. And if, as long as it's a zero-sum game in the HUD budget, you sort of end up in those sort of unfortunate dynamics. But part of the ask, if you will, from a lot of advocacy organizations, APA included, has been to adjust that cap for HUD and transportation to get us out of the situation where the housing part of HUD is always growing at the expense of the HUD part of HUD. looking at transportation, this is switching back to looking at the final funding level in the omnibus bill. You can see here that the Tiger Grant program remains in the budget and is funded at $500 million, slightly down from previous level. But again, if you recall the previous slide, the House had proposed only $100 million for the program. Tiger's interesting. This is the creation of the stimulus program back in the early days of the Obama administration, but it has survived. And in fact, has grown a lot more bipartisan over time. In fact, the new chairman of the subcommittee in the Senate that's responsible for transportation funding, Senator Collins of Maine, is actually one of the lead sponsors of legislation to make Tiger permanent. So it's a program that often it has been targeted, particularly in the House, but it has begun to attract broader and bipartisan support, in part because the transportation budget, as we're going to talk about in a few minutes when we talk about MAP 21, has not grown. So this is one of the few pots of transportation dollars that has increased over the years. And the New START program, the transit program, most of transportation is not really addressed in this omnibus bill because it is funded through MAP 21. It's not subject to annual appropriations because it's funded through the Highway Trust Fund. But the transit program, along with the New START, is discretionary, and so it actually saw a slight increase in this bill. In terms of some of the policy provisions in the omnibus, just want to touch on this real quick. One of the things that we were disappointed by in the omnibus relates to the Tiger program. Tiger, over the years, has gone back and forth as to whether or not they will allow planning grants to be eligible uses under Tiger. For about half of the years that we've had Tiger around, planning was available. For about the other half, it has been capital only. This bill specifically says no plan grants, which is not what USDOT has pushed for, certainly not what APA has pushed for. So one of our advocacy areas of endeavor going forward will be to try to restore planning and eligibility under Tiger for future years. On the positive side of the ledger for Tiger, I mentioned the requirement that the House has proposed to limit grants only for highway construction was not included. That was dropped in this language. They also weighed in on one of the arguments that had been raised inside the USDOT related to bike and pedestrian safety. One of the things MAP 21 required USDOT to do was develop a series of performance measures that would be used in the transportation planning process. And DOT has been having an internal debate as to whether or not they needed a separate measure that looked specifically at bike and pedestrian safety. This bill requires that they do so. So from a bike and pedestrian advocate point of view, that was a significant victory. It also continued to include a set aside for green infrastructure in the primary program at EPA that the state used to fund water infrastructure, which is, again, not something that a lot of plans supported and something that we considered a victory in the overall bill. One last bit of business I want to touch on from last year is on the tax side. This wasn't included in the omnibus bill, but it was one of the last bills that went to the President before the end of the Congress. About 55 provisions of the tax code formally expired January 1 of 2014. And throughout the course of the year, here, Congress was trying to figure out a way to renew some of those provisions or make some of them permanent or extend some of them but not others. And it had been quite a big debate. Ultimately, for a whole lot of reasons that I'm going to focus on in the Q&A, Congress couldn't come to an agreement on the entire package for longer-term extension. So what they opted to do was simply extend all of those measures through the end of 2014. So they literally passed the bill about December 22nd that extended the provisions until December 31st. So those provisions have now all expired again. It's important that week extension was actually valuable because it means that they also made those retroactive to January 1. So if you were interested in using any of those tax credit provisions, you still could in the tax year. The problem for a lot of our interest, things like the new markets tax credit, which was included in all of this, is that those tax credits are important for financing projects. So you can't really take into account projects that weren't built because of the uncertainty around how the tax credits would be applied. It's a little bit easier if you're a corporation trying to take advantage of the research and development tax credit, because those are R&D expenses that you're probably going to have regardless. What this means in practical terms, though, is that this fight is just going to replay itself in 2015. A few of these provisions are really important from a planning perspective. I mentioned the market tax credit. There's some provisions related to low-income housing tax credit that are included in this, as well as a provision related to the tax benefit for transit commuters compared to the tax benefit for parking. Commuting would make those two things equivalent. So I think tax reform is something we're going to hear a lot about. That means this whole extenders discussion is likely to be something that is on the agenda, but harder to complete work on until we find ourselves again in that December timeframe where we have to figure out what will be extended what won't. I think from a longer-term advocacy perspective, it makes it really important that we look at pushing for some of these provisions, like the new market tax credit, to just be made permanent and to get out of the game of annual extensions, which really become an opportunity to tack on other kinds of policy provisions for what's considered a must-pass bill at the end of the year. But that has some budgetary implications. So there is bipartisan legislation to make new markets permanent. There's an opportunity in the transportation bill to deal with transit parity. So part of our tax agenda will be trying to address extenders. So let me pivot now from what was to what we expect will be in the 114th Congress that just convened. Let me start with four dates to keep in mind. The first I've already alluded to is the end of February, February 27th, when funding for Homeland Security will expire. So the very first month COVID deadline will hit us in a month or so related to funding for Homeland Security. March 15th is when we get to debate the debt ceiling once again. This has become an opportunity for a lot of gamesmanship and a lot of difficult negotiations. It has shut the government down in the past. We will see what happens. I think there's limited appetite to replay some of those things. The new majority in Congress, I think, at least at this stage, is eager to appear to be a governing majority as opposed to one willing to crash the bus, so to speak. So I think there's interest in trying to deal with this in a way that is not conducive to provoking a crisis in the first few months of this Congress, but it is something that will have to be dealt with very early on. May 31st, the next deadline, this is when the Surface Transportation Law, Map 21, expires. So if Congress doesn't act either with a pass or a new bill by the end of May, then the highway trust funds will go broke and transportation dollars will dry out. And January 1, so that's not 2015, it's 2016, of course, that's when our old friend sequestration comes back. Do you remember sequestration? Another great word that Washington has popularized. Is across the board budget cut, designed to sort of force Congress to take fiscal action and come to an agreement. Both sides, again, dislike sequestration for different reasons, and there will be a lot of effort to try to deal with it, but if there isn't some sort of new budget agreement that supersedes it, sequestration would return, which would have an effect on all of the domestic discretionary programs. Let me focus for a bit on some of our top priorities as we move into the new Congress. I'll start on the transportation side. Map 21, as I mentioned, expires here in just a few months. It was originally going to expire last year, and Congress provided a temporary extension of about 6 or 7 months to get it to the end of May. They did this largely by tapping instead of fixing the source of revenue for transportation programs, which is gas tax. which runs the Highway Trust Fund. They took money from a lot of different sources, a lot of one-time fixes that will be difficult for them to pack again, like leaking underground storage tanks and tension smoothing and all sorts of non-transportation related items. But the problem that they have is just basic math. The gas tax at its current level brings in round figures, about $34 to $35 billion a year. Matching one funding level provides outlays, revenues that go out to fund projects, at about $50 billion. So you've got a gap there that even if they chose to say, look, we need 6 more months to figure out the policy side of surface transportation, they would have to figure out how to take revenues from other funding sources in the federal government to cover that gap in order to keep the program solvent. Otherwise, they would have to reduce program outlays to levels consistent with where the revenues are on the gas tax. So that's a big problem. And in fact, when you look at the debate around MAP 21 a couple of years ago, the two-year bill, a lot of the policy disputes weren't that significant. And going into this reauthorization, I would say while there are some points of controversy, there's still large areas of agreement about what the substance of the program should look like. The big problem is no one can figure out how to pay for the bill that everyone wants to write. So whether you're talking about the Republican chairman of the respective committees, or you're talking about the administration, everyone will tell you they want what APA has asked for, which is a multi-year bill, right? We need more than just 1 or 2 years in order to plan effectively. We need some certainty. And it needs to be funded in a way that we're not going to have repeated solvency crises in the trust fund. Everyone agrees. The chairman of the House Transportation Committee, Mr. Schuster, gave a speech just this morning where he committed to a five-year bill. And that's great and to be applauded. A five-year bill is going to be a heavy lift on the revenue side. And so that's going to be one of the real struggles. Some people have argued that the crash in oil prices, which have resulted in much lower fuel costs, gives us breathing space to consider an increase of the overall gas tax, which hasn't been raised since 1993, so 20 years at the same level. I still think that's going to be very, very challenging to do, at least as a standalone provision. There may be some opportunities as broadly, you know, if you consider a broader revenue or budget package to do something with the gas tax. It's going to be very difficult to achieve that. Even the administration has been resolutely unwilling to talk about a gas tax issue. So that means we're going to have to look for some other options if the gas tax isn't going to be the magic bullet. There might be some small gas tax increases combined with other revenues from tax reform. We'll just have to see, but that is going to be sort of the core challenge that we face on reauthorization. So APA has, as you can imagine, the transportation bill covers a wide range of topics. We have some areas of particular focus. The first is building on some of the reforms that are already in place in MAP 21. So it was a two-year bill, so on things like the new performance-based planning program that was included in MAP 21, DOT is literally still writing the rules for how to implement all of the facets of the performance measures program. So it's not a very good time to throw out that package and start over with something fresh. So what we have called for is let's stay the course on some of the performance-based planning reforms. Let's continue some of the innovations that were included, like the transit lane development grants for planning, which was designed to sort of give some extra resources to folks on the land use piece connected with new transit investments, new freight planning requirements. All these new programs that are planning-related to teaming with MAP 21 need time to take hold so that they can be thoughtfully evaluated and used. Secondly, the Transportation Alternatives Program. This is the old enhancements program where a lot of funding for trails, pedestrian projects came from. This was recapped as Transportation Alternatives in MAP 21. We have strongly supported enhancements, and we support the continuation of this program through the Alternatives package. There's broad supporting Anthony's program, but there's some important people in key spots in leadership who really don't like it. And we saw an effort to eliminate it in MAP 21 in the debate leading up to that because it was considered non-essential. And in fact, renaming it alternatives was sort of a soft to some of those points of view. So I expect we will see some challenges for the programming and reauthorization. Thirdly, one of the cornerstones of the policy guides that we have adopted as an organization going all the way back to IT have focused on multimodal balance and ensuring that there's a more equitable distribution among the modes in the federal program. So we continue to support that sort of balanced approach, as well as some continuation of TIGER or a TIGER-wide program that is flexible, multimodal. Local jurisdictions are eligible to apply and receive those dollars. It could be called something other than TIGER, but that concept, we think, is really important going forward. And then, of course, as I mentioned before, sort of the cornerstone of all this is we need a bill with some certainty, both in terms of the length of the legislation and the stability of the overall funding. So, if transportation is one of the main priorities, a second would be the overall appropriations process. This is simply the funding level for programs that allow communities to implement good plans. There are some real challenges here. I'm not going to go into these in detail, but I will just say that they don't have a lot of room to grow the overall pie for these programs, which is going to put the same kind of insurance we've seen in the last few years on the process this year. And things like the debt ceiling and the debate about sequestration could have a negative impact as well. This slide just tries to give you a sense of the timeline that we're looking at for when kind of key decisions will be made. The President's budget, which outlines their proposals for funding all these programs, will come out the first Monday in February. I mentioned DHS expiring at the end of that month. Then we have the debt ceiling. So real action on appropriations is a spring and summer activity. So when we talk about opportunities for you to weigh in with your elected officials and support of programs that you use, really important to get those in the spring and early summer as this process begins to unfold at the committee level. And then it has to be wrapped up in some fashion by the time the new fiscal year starts on October 1. That has not happened in many, many years. There's almost always a continuing resolution or some sort of dodge at that first day of the fiscal year. I don't expect this year will be any easier or any different, but that's yet another deadline that Congress has to deal with. So in terms of our perspective, the ACA perspective, on the appropriations priorities, obviously the first order of business is we've got to deal with this Homeland Security question, because hazard mitigation is an important priority. We have a new policy guide on this topic, a lot of research work that's gone into this area, and it's been a consistent legislative priority for us. So a lot of member concern about this. So making sure that FEMA programs that address hazard sites stay in place. And then for these key programs, things like CDBG and the TIGER program, with neighborhoods in line, at a minimum, we want to see things not get worse. And I know that's maybe not the inspirational battle cry that sets hearts and minds on fire, but it, realistically speaking, we will urge increases in some of these programs. But much like the omnibus being a victory by staying roughly level, I think that would be a positive outcome if we could maintain funding in all these programs. And one area that I think often we don't talk about as much as things like CDBG, but it's important, particularly as we roll toward a new census in 5 years, and that's federal data programs. There have been efforts in the last two Congresses to either eliminate or constrain the American Community Survey, which is a growing number of programs at the state level as well as the federal level. That data is used to actually drive the allocations of funds from various programs. I think there could be a real attack on some of these things. And the census folks will tell you that while 5 years seems like a long time, when you're gearing up to do a nationwide census, every year in the run-up to that decennial is really critical in order for them to get an accurate count. So shortchanging that program in 2015 would really hurt the 2020 census. So federal data programs very much on our radar screen. And then on the programmatic side, we continue to believe that a lot of these programs are improved by providing set-aside and eligibility specifically related to planning. So part of our message is always that, you know, it's one thing to debate, are we going to spend the money or not? But if we know we're going to spend the money on programs, we also know that providing more resources for effective planning ensures that, whatever level of money we're going to provide on the capital side is most wisely spent and spent in a way that most reflects the concerns of local communities, which are few arguments, the efficiency areas and the local perspective argument that I think have some greater interest on the Republican side. So it's a way to message that these programs in the new Congress. Infrastructure finance, this is related, of course, to the transportation bill, but there's some elements to this that are broader than the transportation infrastructure and could be addressed outside the context of MAP 21, so one of it appears sort of a separate item. Largely what we're talking about here, some of it's the expenditures that I mentioned, but some of it is using corporate tax reform to create some new pot of money through various mechanisms, and there are several proposals that are out there that would act as an infrastructure bank. That would just be a new pot of resources that would, depending on whose proposal is accepted, we just provide a separate line of both funding and financing to promote these projects. APA has worked on one specific proposal called the Partnership to Build America Act, which is one of many versions that deal with the whole issue of repatriation of overseas earnings, so bringing them back onshore by giving them a preferential tax treatment and then capturing that revenue, some amount of it or in some fashion, to fund infrastructure. It won't necessarily provide a long-term solution like a gas tax increase would because it's not in perpetuity, but it would give us an opportunity to pay down some of the backlog that exists. We're also looking at the issue of the Marketplace Fairness Act, and this is essentially improving and allowing states to collect sales tax on online purchases. Increasingly local governments see this as critical, state governments as well, to being able to capture more revenue as more of the challenge on things like transportation infrastructure are pushed to localities, those budgets are now constrained. So this is another component of the overall tax debate. And then the last thing here is a program called TIFIA, which is essentially a loan guarantee program that was expanded dramatically in MAP 21. So a lot of people now look to the model for how we might, if we can't do full funding, at least we can do more on credit and financing programs to support projects, to encourage public-private partnerships. So there's a WICIA program, which is for water infrastructure. There's also a proposal that's out now to apply the same mechanism for bike, pedestrian, parkland, recreational projects. So this idea of a federal loan or loan guarantee program for community infrastructure is something that, I think is a way forward, at least for some programs with a limited budgetary impact at the federal level. The last key issue I want to talk about is hazards. I mean, this is clearly connected, as Bill noted earlier in his remarks this morning, to climate change. Climate change is not an issue that we think is likely to see a whole lot of attention other than some of the amendments that have been happening over the last couple of days related to the Keystone Pipeline. Kind of hard to see Congress, this Congress being able to tackle something like a carbon tax or cap and trade or any of those solutions. But the flip side of the issue, helping communities deal with hazards that we know are coming and getting more intense, is an area where we think there's opportunity to make some advances. So obviously the first thing here is we've got to keep the mitigation programs we have active and funded. Secondly, APA has been a founding partner of this coalition called the Digital Coast Partnership, where we have worked with NOAA to essentially make better use of coastal geographic data that the federal government already collects, so that it can be packaged in a way that local planners, local governments, regional bodies can use that data more effectively to do better modeling and better planning for things like flood disasters, coastal sea level rise, things of that nature. There is a Republican who is taking the lead on this. Don Young from Alaska is the lead sponsor of legislation in the House that would make the digital coast something more than an informal partnership, where NOAA has worked with about 10 nonprofit organizations like APA on this over the years to actually make it a formal program. And there's legislation on the Senate side as well. Clearly in a state like Louisiana, this kind of program could have a significant impact. And then the last area is we're trying to take a look at things like resiliency standards for infrastructure programs, so that we're trying to ensure that the infrastructure dollars that go out through these federal programs that I've been talking about are spent as wisely as possible when we take things like hazards into account. And also new incentives, so that when we talk about things like water infrastructure, water resources, water planning, there's been a lot of innovative water planning that's gone on in this state. It can really be a model for communities around the country. We think there's an opportunity through technical business research and incentives to sort of encourage that kind of the innovative planning in an area where whatever people disagree and are about the root cause, people do understand that hazards are happening and are important for us to deal with. Not getting into detail here, but I did want to just mention quickly that while I focus a lot of this presentation on the legislative side, there's a lot of stuff happening on the regulatory side of the ledger that's important to planning as well. And frankly, a lot of stuff is going to happen legislatively to undo some of the regulatory stuff. So you can see here things like new guidance on how the NEPA process should incorporate climate impact. There's new guidance that's been released late last year on that. EPA wetlands rule, which has been enormously controversial, is something that will be dealt with in 2015. If you work on fair housing issues, probably saw the Supreme Court heard a case just yesterday on the use of disparate impact in fair housing. The case where APA actually filed a brief, and you can read all the details about that on the web. But it's also important to the fair housing rule that HUD is planning to release later this year as well. So lots of stuff going on there. We've also been heavily involved as a partner with HUD on their new resiliency program, where they were able to take $1 billion that was originally earmarked for Sandy relief in the Northeast, make it available nationwide as a resiliency competition. That process, again, will be unfolding over the course of the year. So let me close by I laid out a whole bunch of stuff that's going on legislatively from our perspective that are important priorities for all of you. But none of that matters if we don't figure out how do we actually win some of these arguments and how can we be more effective. I hope we can get some of that in the conversation about ways that this chapter can be more effective on state issues. But certainly, we have an interest in galvanizing the 38,000 members of the organization in a way that becomes a more potent voice for many of these issues. I'm not going to go into detail here, but let me just throw out five quick ideas that I think can be useful. They're not magic bullets, magic tricks of the imagination, but as we think about how do we begin to win through these debates. The first is, we know we're dealing with a new Congress, and even if you're focused on advocacy at a different level, many states are seeing the same reality that we're seeing at the federal level of Republican majorities, a conservative governing philosophy that's leading the way legislatively. So that means, I think, we have to be really focused on our messages. How are we talking about our programs? I think it's easy for us to sound sort of reflexively defensive of the regulatory state, but that's what we do. That's how we maintain the community. And while that's hugely valuable, and I don't want to underline that in any way, I think we need a language that allows us to speak to some of the values that are prevalent in state capitals and certainly in Congress. I thought, for those of you who were here for Bill's remarks earlier, we talked about how do you translate the sort of language of sustainability that we're comfortable with, environmental issues, economic issues, equity issues, into language that has broader based appeal. You talk about things like health. As a for instance, quality jobs and access. That kind of ability to pivot in your messaging can be helpful. Secondly, you are sitting on an enormous asset, and that is the ability to take any of these programs and turn them into local stories. I found one of the most powerful ways to communicate to legislative staff in particular is to focus less on the he said, she said of the federal budget process and instead talk about impact in real people's lives in the communities that they represent. At the end of the day, politics is always going to be about geography and about the area, the specific geography that an individual represents. And because you're active on the ground, you can speak directly to these stories and humanize them, but also provide data and provide information to understand how a program that, you know, when we talk about $3 billion for CDBG, that can seem like a very abstract number, but you can talk about how many thousands of dollars that went into individual projects that had very discernible positive outcomes. And those are the sorts of stories we have to capture, and we have to figure out how to tell and to tell more effectively. The third, this is about relationship building. So it's very difficult to influence a legislator or an executive branch official at the end of a process. You have to sort of be there all the way through. So demonstrating that you are willing to be engaged, that you're willing to work with an office, that you are a resource, that you can help them with issues that arise in their work, allow you to build a relationship so that when planning-related issues come to that legislator or that official, they already see you as a partner and as a resource and are willing to come to you and say, what are the impacts that you see of this language? Or can you help us craft this particular provision? Or what do you think about it? And that's where you can be a really influential advocate. I put partnerships up here, too, because we're not going to be able to do this alone. And one of the great strengths of APA and the planners generally is a terrific understanding of the value of partnership. So if there are things that are hard to do individually, I think there are a lot of partners, whether they are professional partners, whether they are people who are working on behalf of the municipality, for instance, can be enormous assets for us as we take our issues and our asks to decision makers. Knowing your audience, knowing what your strengths are, think about that legislator, what makes them tick, how they see the world, what gets them up in the morning, what keeps them up at night. If you understand those issues, then you may figure out how you can frame planning and planning issues in a way that are resonant, and also what your strengths are. We know there are things that planners are perceived as valued messengers on, and things where we might not be the best messenger, so understanding those as well. And then lastly, I would really encourage you, stay informed and stay engaged. Simple persistence is so valuable in grassroots advocacy of all stripes. We try to provide an array of information resources so that if anything I said on the federal side piques your interest and you want to know what's happening with Tiger Grant Program or the future surface transportation authorization, you can go to our website, you can go to our blog, you can sign up for newsletters. There are all sorts of materials that are out there so that you can understand where in the process is important for you to be engaged. And it's our commitment to provide as many platforms and opportunities for you to be engaged with us. There is nothing that I can do alone that's going to be anywhere near as persuasive as our ability to work together and for all of you to be involved in shaping this program at the local level, at the state level, and ultimately at the federal level. Now, the last thing I'm going to say is I have never given any version of this presentation, for the very first question, or among the first questions, was related to the issue of LOISA. I can't advocate. I'm a planner, I work in local government. This is not what I do. Let me just tackle that up front before you have a chance to ask me. My answer to the question is, can you be an advocate? It's simply yes. Right. Now, what your advocacy looks like may well be dictated by your distinctive circumstances, the nature of your job, the community that you work in. Are you public sector, are you private sector, your own personal willingness to stand up and be counted and how you can do that. But there are various avenues and levels. I would also argue that if you look at the history of the Klan movement in this country, it is rooted in a sense of what is best in the public interest and how can we work together to craft public policies in a way that protects and advances those interests. And that is the very essence of advocacy. And so when we talk about planners as, hey, we can't be advocates, I think that runs counter to really the true spirit of what it is that you're doing in community. And there are ways, whether that is influencing elected officials and allowing those local leaders to become the face and voice for issues that we care about, whether it's working in partnership, whether it's sending letters, whether it's working through APA, whether it's being engaged at the chapter level as a volunteer in a committee. There are any number of ways to make your voice heard, and I hope that you will work with me, and together we can figure out how to make all of us better advocates. Thank you.
Wow, that really tied together our mayor's roundtable. I mean, I think we started already partnering with the Louisiana Municipal Association, which of course has all mayors and councilmen and other elected officials from all over the state. We want to engage you and find out what your priorities are. So I'd ask Ed to come up and kind of give us an overview of where we're going from here.
Thank you. This one?
I think you're right here. Right,
okay. Thank you. All right. Well, those of you who, first of all, know me, know I try to keep myself brief. I'm giving myself 7 minutes in this joke. There's a lot of people who don't know I will be for 7 minutes. I'm going to do my best. Basically, APA Louisiana has won a $3,800 grant from the Chapter President Council with the purpose of enhancing our legislative advocacy program. This idea came to us through not only our members, but also our our Leadership Institute, who graduated last year after a several-month intensive series of instruction regarding how does the chapter operate, how does the organization operate. And what we did is we put on the table their recommendations regarding legislation. It's important to note that when we talk about our legislative activity, we do have a program that exists currently. We do have a committee, we do have volunteers who help us watch legislation. We also have chapter members who volunteer to be part of work groups, and we'll talk a little bit about that. And then we also do participate in APA's federal endeavors in the Fall Leadership Conference. Now, of course, we can say that at the chapter we've been very successful thanks to the efforts of many volunteers. For those of you who are familiar with Act 859 and have planning commissioners coming tomorrow, please, again, be aware that APA Louisiana was instrumental in getting that legislation passed. We've also been on several work groups that look at policy issues at the state level, most notably Complete Streets, coordinating human services transportation, and also the most recent Housing and Transportation Planning Coordinating Committee, which is a mouthful that actually is operating right now. And we're very thankful that when we ask chapter volunteers to be a part of these things, they actually go to meetings for us, have great ideas, and provide sustainable input. And I think that's most appreciated by the partners who are there. Now, one of the things when we look at our legislative advocacy program is to figure out where do we start. We have, again, this program that works, but we want to make it a little better. And we have, the first place to start is actually our mission statement, which if you notice in yellow, we do have a role in impacting public policy. And this is something that we want to build upon in this year with the idea that the program we start now will continue in the future. Now, certainly, when we look at energizing and electrifying our efforts here on the Capitol, we do want to make sure that our program is representative of our members. And one of the things that we've done is we are providing an opportunity for our members to be involved, and it actually starts in today's workshop. We invited Jason to come give you the federal perspective, because I think it's important to understand that APA is a very strong advocate for many things, and in being an advocate, they're also very well informed. However, one of the things that Jason talked about is that they start every year with talking to members, and those of us who did the Interact called the survey that went out in November asking us about our opinion regarding priority issues. So one of the things we want to do today, which Kim and Lydia are going to work on, and myself is to provide that digital survey to our members here, and we're also going to supplement that with an online survey. We would like to put together some groups to look at some key issues. And again, we have a lot of issues identified, but we realize time is short and we want to stay focused to maybe a handful, like 3 to 5. We also want to develop some information on these to figure out which is a position you can take as an organization, who needs to be involved with this in terms of partners, and again, what do we bring to the table as policy planners, private sector, public sector planners across the state. We had scheduled, at the time the grant was submitted, a visitation in the spring, that this was before oil dropped at $40,000 a barrel, and we had Governor Chandler coming out calling for special sessions. So that may be a little more fluid. But before we go out there and get ourselves on thin ice, there's a couple of things we need to remember, and our leadership industry practice will appreciate this. One of the things that we need to remember that as a parent, as a member of a much larger organization, we need to remember that AK itself is an education and advocacy organization. So when we come to this, we're coming at a position from education and advocacy, which means that not only are we talking about the issues, but we do want to tell people what is planning, a little bit about what it is we do, and how we actually have a positive impact in our community. Now, of course, we got to first of all decide what is it we're going to talk about, and there's a lot of things that we can choose from, and that's the purpose of today's survey. But ultimately, we want to know, at the end of this, how can we do this, and how can we be more effective? We realize that other chapters are going through the same discussions as we are. Some are very open in admitting that they're very reactive as opposed to proactive. We would like to move to the proactive side of the meter, but we realize it's going to take some work. So with that, the 2 minutes to spare, I turn it over to Tim.
Thanks, Ed. My part is going to be very simple, and because I'm going to have somebody else do most of it. I'm going to ask Derek and a couple of students to come up and pass out the survey. I'd like to point out that we have a number of UNO graduate students working here as volunteers. Derek, Colin, anybody else? I saw a couple other girls, Dakota was here. Those are our future planners in this state, so you should get to know them, and we've got quite a number of outstanding students and actually former students who are here, including Paul back there. But we have something else I want to touch on too, and Ed mentioned this. Ed, one of the great things Ed did a couple of years ago was start the Leadership Institute. We got a grant from APA National, and to make a long story short, what it did is identify future leaders of our chapter of the national organization and all the way down to the metro section, and not professionalized, and there's a number of folks who graduated from that Leadership Institute have already moved up to leadership positions on the chapter executive committee and the metro section. So we're going to be counting on that, among others, for this legislative thing. The survey being passed out now is a list of a few possible issues that we as a chapter may want to consider. Going back to one of Ed's slides, we're a volunteer organization. We tried to hire Jason to come work for us, but he wanted to get paid. And we said, well, we can't pay you. But actually, some chapters, and I can name a couple, Texas and Florida, are so big and have so many members, so much money, they actually do have a paid staff APA person on the chapter level. We don't have that, unfortunately. So we rely on members to guide us, and that's going to help us in our legislative endeavors. We're reforming our legislative committee. We have a number of volunteer seasoned folks in the audience, and plus the young folks, the young leadership to help us. So what you have in front of you is at the bottom of the first page is a number of items, a possible possible issues that you would like to see the chapter and our legislative efforts go towards. So what we're asking you to do is pick six of these, I think there are about 17 or 18 of these issues, and mark your top six with an X. And if there's an issue that's not on here that you feel is important, you turn the page over and list those on the top of the next page. And then there's a section that says, rank your top three. So, some are all the ones on that you mark the next on the first page, or the one that you listed yourself that's not on that front list. Put that in there. And this is the important thing about, that I just mentioned was, volunteering and assisting in the effort to address these priorities. So there's a couple of questions about will you be able to assist, volunteer in some capacity, because we need all the help we can get, and it's a team effort. And then, of course, your section, Metro, Indiana Capital, or North Louisiana, your email address. But if you do volunteer, we know how to find you. So there's a box on the table in the back. As you leave, just drop that in. I think we're also going to have the survey on the chapter website. Yes, they're saying yes. And then at some point we'll take all these numbers and figure out what the priorities that you guys have voted on and put them in the newsletter on the website. And that way we'll know how to tackle and address these issues. So I'm going to turn this back over to Lydia, but I think that's us working among ourselves, our volunteers working with National. We're fortunate to have national leadership here. Again, we're a small chapter. I'm not sure if most chapters at their conference get the director, the president, and Jason here all at one time, but we managed to do that, and we're very fortunate to do this. So I'm going to turn this back over to Lydia. Leslie, I'm looking at Leslie over there. Hi, Leslie. We're going to volunteer, Leslie. Thank you.
Okay, guys, do you want to give everybody a little bit of time on our survey? Should we open up the questions and answers? Okay, let's go to questions and answers while y'all are filling out your surveys. Do we have any questions or comments for Jason? Yes, Bob.
Questions for Bob Park and Recreation Funding. And I was on the survey, I wanted to give you any one of the priorities that that state or local planning authority has been under the exactly what
sure. On the issue of park funding, you're right, that's a big issue, and we're in the spring and we'll be spending days. The main focus for us has been the Landmark Conservation Fund. The administration has proposed that funding become mandatory, and we supported that proposition is unlikely to become law. But we have particularly on the state side, LAGF funding, those are resources that can make some challenges for a whole variety of purposes. We've been working with a number of groups, the American Society of Landscape Architects and the National Recreation Park Association, on support for permanent easy park funding in the process. So it is a priority, and it's one that is seriously addressing, I think, right now. In fact, there was an amendment that was offered and drawn in the Senate on the T-Zone pipeline debate that would have required the Interior Department to make a finding that before any funds were sent to require any funds before being made out of living using private dollars, that they were fully resourcing existing recreation activities, which is really the backdoor way of preventing a lot of funding flowing through the CCF. So ultimately that's watered down and happens. I think it's indicative of the spirit of the challenge. On the issue that you referenced in the priority, the committee, the legislative policy committee, draft that
set a priority and eliminate those to the board of directors for ratification on an annual basis across the office members and their votes. You know, our appetite is always large because planning is so bad for every so many things. But sometimes we try to package a couple of different issues in the language of the existing priorities. But that one really is focused on about two major issues. One, pain. So when we talk about respecting, you know, existing gay law and the rights of local communities, what we're really talking about there is we don't want Congress to go back to considering, you know, regulatory change legislation that has been proposed for many years. However, the second aspect of that that is also important, and maybe particularly important to state like Louisiana, the committee felt strongly that as energy issues have risen before, that it's important when we talk about things like the pipeline or other sorts of energy-related infrastructure, that local voices, how local plans are actually considered in that process. So we continue to reflect that. There's a little bit of a third issue related to telecommunications facilities. There's some changes in federal law as well as regulatory changes from the FCC in terms of how local communities can the parameters within which they can review telecommunications infrastructure requests and permits. And so a number of the past priorities intended to sort of cut across some of the specifics and say, look, local prerogatives are important and local plans are important to be given in consideration.
And I think also on that, land use and zoning seems to be really respected in the federal process. I know in all the NEPA processes that we go through, one of the things that we do is we look at the land use and we look at the zoning and we look at the impacts of the project on the local development. And it seems to be that zoning, and I probably shouldn't say this out loud, but land use and zoning seems to be the last vestige of local authority that the federal government has in law and that they actually respect it. So it's a good thing for us in our profession. Do we have any other
skills there? You talked about how much you focus on federal regulations and rulemaking has more than that. How much of that is the work of the United States and those on the state you have to talk about the Louisiana rules or anything, but you also have to have things and have to be aware of those. They have to talk about how much you have to have legislation on our own.
Yeah, absolutely agree. Those are major priorities for us. At the national level to carefully monitor. We regularly provide comments for considering when the things go through the comment period. I'm real pleased that I would have on this front, regulars in particular, member voices are really critical in that process because often, these are really about pragmatic, very specific local implementation issues. So, work organizations or work chapters to try to solicit input on those. There are a lot of areas where we could be engaged. Some instances, and a good example of this would be some of the power plant rules on the climate side. So we do more reporting so that people are aware of what's happening and make their own determinations about does it affect me locally or my community, not my way in. And in other areas, like an FCC issue related to telecom power, where it's clearly at a level where it gets to weigh in as an organization. Okay. This flows through our legislative policy committee, but we try to always have interact, our contact with the organization on the website, call for input on those. You're always going to see stuff out there, and if you call our attention, please email me or call me so that we're getting your input and aware of stuff that is defined important for the community.
Okay.
Do we have
any others? Well, Eric, something I'm really about too, and I do this personally, I know the Federal Highway and Federal Transit, and maybe those rulemaking comments I get 15 minutes like the planning box. That's a very small site of federal government, and I know most agencies agree that way. In terms of the chapter, right now, there is a reactive mode when it comes to things, and part of that is because again, we really didn't have an idea where the priorities should be, and that's part of the reason we applied for this grant. But we do have someone who's watched the state legislatively for us, and he's very good at alerting us to upcoming legislation that could be detrimental to the practice of land use and zoning in the state. And we also have gotten notices from our land records council in previous years regarding four members that have heard about things previously. And sent that to the committee for review. We have had some members of them that have misinterpreted us looking at policy and us weighing in on projects. And I know that I'm the chapter president, I've been asked to weigh in on specific projects that were occurring in various jurisdictions on behalf of the organization. And I can tell you that that's really not our role in this process for advocacy. We're looking at the local picture. That said, I really don't care if you're using paving stones or concrete and sidewalks down at that rate. That's a local decision, but if you're using enhancement funds efficiently and effectively, I'm all for the enhancement program. And APA Louisiana has passed a resolution of support for Complete 3. So if it's a Complete 3 project, that's what we say. We're in favor of Complete 3. How do you do that locally is a local decision. And I think that's one of the issues I've had to hear, you know, rules and other things. It's something that affects the state, but no, our system is not really a formalized in APA. But if you're looking for us to make it under local decisions, that we're not standing for that.
Before we do this, for the grant, I mentioned the NEPA guidance that's out. That's the one where we're currently soliciting input. So if you are interested in other NEPA correspondence and want to review that and let us know what things would be great.
Okay, do we have any other questions or comments? All right, well with that, I think we need to thank Jason again.